Welcome to the Morning Magazine here on KGNU Community Radio. It's July 4th of 2023. I'm your host, Shannon Young. Today, we continue our special week of coverage featuring picks from our summer reading lists. It's also high season for summer festivals, and we'll hear a report from Telluride about efforts to celebrate that culture in a new museum exhibit. A BBC News update is at the bottom of the hour. Then it's How on Earth. This week's KGNU Science Show is all about superconductors. At 9 a.m. comes another archival recording of the wit and wisdom of Alan Watts. Then at 9:30, James Wise will be in the Boulder studio for the Morning Sound Alternative. That's all still ahead, but first, we're going to take you to Telluride. Colorado is known for its summer music scene and for its culture of outdoor festivities in general. The remote town of Telluride has long embodied that festival culture, and as KOTO's Gavin McGough reports for Rocky Mountain Community Radio, a new exhibit takes a deep dive into the town's festival history.
Something told me it was over, baby. When I saw you and that girl and y'all was talking. Something deep down in my soul.
The sound of Telluride's history is, in part, the sound of Etta James.
I'd like to thank you for having me at your Telluride Jazz Festival this year. Thank you.
That's the blues legend performing circa 1980 at the Telluride Jazz Fest, piped into the creaky walls of the Weatherford Gallery upstairs at the Telluride Historical Museum, where curator of collections Molly Daniel greets me to take me back in time.
This exhibit is about the 50th anniversary of both the Bluegrass Festival, the Film Festival, but it also celebrates as many festivals as we could fit in this space that have contributed to Telluride's culture and community and kind of made it the town that we love today.
What does a room full of festival memorabilia look like? Posters, over 50 of them, line the walls, alongside historic photographs, wristbands, and entry cards, of course, newspaper clippings, and one enormous Main Street banner running the length of the ceiling and blooming with a funky freeform geometry.
And this was made by Naomi Salzman. It's one of these beautiful handmade banners. It's got these really lovely, fun, abstract shapes that are vibrant colors. You walk in and it just feels like the energy of a festival in Telluride, which is why I chose this one.
Naomi Salzman was the daughter of Emmanuel, whose name you might recognize as one of the founders of Mushroom Fest. Although Mushroom Festival is certainly storied, the two 50-year-old juggernauts which ground the exhibition are the Bluegrass Festival and the Film Fest. Daniel takes us into the history of the latter.
And I think a lot of its history has the Sheridan Opera House to thank. The couple that bought it, the Pences, had a good friend, Jim Card, who wanted to screen some of his film collection here in Telluride, and that eventually evolved into the full festival. So early on, the festival was a lot more about kind of a revival of the classics and showing old archival films and retrospectives, that kind of thing.
But Telluride's festival culture goes much deeper than film or bluegrass. Again, here's Daniel.
The idea of festivals kind of begins with the 4th of July. And you can date Telluride's 4th of July tradition as far back as early 1880s. and it was obviously it's a big deal today. It was a much bigger deal back then. The miners would get several days off of work. There'd be these big competitions. You could win a lot of money.
For decades, that tradition of an enormous 4th of July celebration held strong. Daniel points out a paper flyer from the mid-20th century listing town events for all ages.
We've got this program from 1941 that I think is really cool, and it just shows you these wide variety of events that happened that year. We have everything from band concerts to sack races. We have a cracker eating contest for younger kids. There's a nail driving contest for girls and women.
An egg race with bring your own teaspoon and egg.
Absolutely. It just goes on and on.
Daniel next draws our attention to another 1800s artifact, a photograph of a dozen or so mustachioed men posing quite formally with a distant view of the bridal veils rising behind them. Each somber figure clutches a brass horn instrument. The photo, it turns out, is of a Telluride band which traveled to the Mountain and Plain Festival in Denver in the 1890s and won the musical competition there 3 years in a row.
And we have this wonderful quote from the newspaper talking about how the band basically deserves all the praises. It has done more to advertise the camp of Telluride and make the thousands of people in Denver familiar with the word Telluride. So they were this beloved band at the time. They did great. Kind of shows you how our culture of music, our love of music here in Telluride goes all the way back to at least the 1890s.
Right.
Yes.
And the idea of promotion is interesting, like making the name of Telluride known in then.
Exactly. Yeah, we haven't always been known for mining there. We've also been known for music as far back as the 1890s.
Having studied and collected so many festival backstories, Daniel has some theories on what has made Telluride the festival capital it is today.
For a lot of these festivals, it's been kind of an outside expert in their field. I'm looking at Chamber Music Mushroom Festival and Balloon Festival, and this was true for each one, where there was a local person who kind of was interested in having this event, and then they were able to pull in an outside expert who was kind of enthusiastic about doing it, and that's kind of how they were able to happen, is we're able to have all these connections with people in other places beyond Telluride.
Once those experts got a taste of the Box Canyon beauty and brought some of their followers along with them, they wanted to return year after year. And the rest, they say, is history.
And another thing is, one more thing is, I just don't want to be free. I'm scared to be by myself.
For KOTO, this is Gavin McGough.
We now turn to our summer reading list. In 2019, Finn Murphy bought a farm in Boulder County, hoping to cash in on the hemp boom. Like thousands of others, he was enticed into the hemp space. But 1 year later, it all went bust. He spoke with Rocky Mountain Community Radio's Maeve Conran about his new book, Rocky Mountain High, A Tale of Boom and Bust in the New Wild West, which chronicles his adventures.
In late 2018, November 2018, the U.S. Farm Bill passed, which made hemp legal for the first time in 83 years. And so the 2019 in Colorado, a whole bunch of us thought, well, now it's legal, let's do that. Prior to 2018, Colorado had pilot programs for hemp. And the University of Colorado was doing hemp research, and Colorado State University was doing hemp research, and the Colorado Department of Agriculture was doing hemp research. So when the Farm Bill passed, Colorado was the only state that had any infrastructure that was built in and ready to go.
In addition to all of that, the Colorado Department of Agriculture really seized on hemp as something that, I'm going to paraphrase here, but I think they felt could really help and impact in a positive way agriculture, and especially maybe smaller farms here in the state. I mean, what was the Colorado Department of Agriculture's role in really pushing hemp as a crop here?
Yeah, they were looking for a solution to small farm bankruptcies in Colorado, which have always been a problem since 1859. So we're talking about small holdings here. So I've got 36 acres. That certainly qualifies as a small farm in Colorado. Corn doesn't work. Sugar beets don't work. Vegetables don't work. You know, we have a rocky alluvial plain in a semi-arid climate. There are very few things that grow that a farmer can actually, you know, stay with his farm, raise his family, make a little bit of money. And that's why hemp was considered to be a very good candidate for this type of farmer.
Now, you were not alone in stepping into what you describe as the hemp space. Who were some of the other folks who were excited by the opportunities, who were investing big, big money into growing hemp?
Yeah, so this had all the classic characteristics of a boom. So we had locals who were eager to ride the wave, like me, even though I wasn't a farmer and have no background in farming whatsoever. You had massive outside investment coming in from New York and Toronto and Dubai. And then you had very significant government support from the Colorado Department of Agriculture. Then you had other business support for ancillary businesses that were going to take part in this. You had support from the universities. And then you had support from the media, and you had fluff pieces, and you had internet chat rooms opening up. So all of these things, each one of these little bricks constructed this wall of the hemp opportunity in Colorado.
And yet, despite all of that, there was inevitably a bust. And so you outline your own personal experience of the bust in your new book. But you experienced so many challenges. It's not just growing the hemp, but of course, it's the processing, it's the selling. And despite the fact that it was included in the Farm Bill, there were still many, many federal barriers, including a limited access to banking and even how do you ship hemp, processed hemp to another state? It keeps getting intercepted. So what were some of the elements that really led to the bust?
Well, all of those elements, and I probably need to correct myself by saying Colorado had the infrastructure in place to grow hemp. Nobody had the infrastructure in place to grow hemp. We had a legal farm bill that made it legal to grow hemp, but there was zero, and there was no other infrastructure to grow hemp. So there was no clearinghouse where you could buy and sell hemp in the marketplace, for example. There was nobody who knew how to grow hemp and how to process hemp, except people who had been growing the other kind of hemp, and they weren't talking. So there wasn't any information on that either. So those were the two big ones. And then you had, 2,554 growers in Colorado growing hemp that year, and there was only about 100 the year before. And so Colorado planted only a couple thousand acres of hemp, and then the next year it was 80,000 acres of hemp, which is 125 square miles of hemp.
Growing hemp is one thing, processing and then selling the hemp is a whole other thing. You mentioned there wasn't a marketplace in which you could actually sell all of this, but there really weren't even the facilities to deal with the crop once it had been grown, let alone store it. That's actually one of the parts of your story. Has that infrastructure improved here in Colorado, the processing, the storage and the marketplace?
No, that's one of the tragedies of this whole thing, is there's no hemp being grown outside in Colorado anymore. None. It's all being done hydroponically inside for a variety of reasons, which I go into in the book. The raison d'etre for hemp being legal in Colorado and what the Colorado Department of Agriculture wanted to do, which was to help small farmers, it didn't work. And so it's over. So there is no hemp infrastructure for hemp. The hemp infrastructure that was built by people like me, we sold it all off for pennies on the dollar and closed it all down. It's done.
Are you seeing a boom in hemp now in other states, as we are seeing this patchwork quilt of legalization, decriminalization of hemp, of cannabis all around the country? Anywhere you're looking to elsewhere in the country that you would like to maybe call up a farmer and go, tread carefully?
If I was going to talk to any farmer about growing hemp, I would say, do not do that. Period. There is no hemp boom in the agricultural sector in any state in the union. People are still trying to grow hemp, maybe for fiber, maybe for building materials, but there's no infrastructure for that either. So right now, the only, if you can call it, mature market for a hemp product would be the CBD droppers that you see all over the place, most of which are probably not what they say they are in the ingredients. There's about 30,000 CBD brands out there right now, and they're all fighting each other like cats in a bag to differentiate each other. I'm not an optimist about hemp. I still love the plant. It's a regenerative plant. It takes all the nasty stuff out of the soil. It's got 25,000 uses that we'll get infrastructure for at some point. But right now, the hemp thing isn't working. But I will say that my foray into this was still a whole lot of fun. I met a whole bunch of great people, and I wouldn't trade it, and I would do it all over again.
Finn Murphy's new book is Rocky Mountain High, a tale of boom and bust in the new Wild West. That story was an excerpt of June's Radio Book Club. You can find the full interview online at news.kgnu.org. Next up, KGNU's young adult book reviewer Phoebe Donovan speaks with Meg Eden Couillette, author of the new book, Good Different.
Meg Eden Couillette, your book is beautifully written. What was your reason behind writing it in verse?
Oh, thanks so much. I think the reason for verse is they have that saying for musical theater that when the emotions get too strong, you stop speaking and you start singing. And when the emotions are too strong for singing, you start dancing. And I think it's the same way for me with verse. Like if the emotions are too strong for just normal writing of prose, like I go to poetry. And so I felt a lot with writing this book. So it came out as poems.
Wow, that's really interesting. When did you start writing in verse, like, originally?
I've been writing poems for a long time. So, middle school, I think I started writing poems. But this was the first time I wrote it as a story, like a novel in verse.
And this story is based on your own life, is that right?
I like to think of it as, like, an emotional autobiography. So it's, like, those literal things didn't happen to me, but the emotion behind it is very, very true.
Oh, that makes sense. So, the main character, Sayla, how much does she resemble you?
She's very, very much like me.
Yeah?
It's like almost exactly me.
Oh, nice. For listeners who may just now be joining us, my guest is Meg Eden Couillette, author of the newly released Good Different. The book is a juvenile fiction novel written in verse that centers around Sayla, a neurodivergent 12-year-old who comes to understand and celebrate her difference. It's so important for books to serve as both windows and as mirrors. Given this, can you talk about how impactful it is for neurodivergent kids to be able to read books with neurodivergent protagonists and also by neurodivergent authors?
Yeah, I love that you bring up that the windows and doors metaphor, because yeah, I think for a lot of neurodivergent kids, there aren't many of those reflections of themselves. And so being able to see a reflection of yourself, you go, oh, it's not just me. Oh, there's somebody else that feels this way too. That means maybe that I'm not the problem. Like maybe there's some other problem. And I know for me, reading a book is not the best example because it was not written by a neurodivergent person, but it was the first time I saw an autistic protagonist. And that's what started my whole journey of actually seeking diagnosis and, you know, this whole journey because I went, wait, there's someone else that thinks like me. And that was just, I was so craving representation of any kind, even though that one, I wouldn't necessarily recommend that book, but I just like, I needed something. So I think it's so important that we have all kinds of representation that kids can see themselves in the pages.
And your book is also very important for people who aren't neurodivergent to read, because it can really provide insight or a window into what a neurodivergent person might be going through. What kind of responses have you had to the book?
So far, very good. Suspicious.
That's good.
Waiting for people that, you know, don't like it because everyone agrees. It's like, okay, well, what's going on here? But so far, it's been really positive, really encouraging hearing, you know, people say, oh, now I feel like I better understand what my grandchild or my child might be going through. Or now my mom better understands what I've been going through. So I've gotten like some really awesome messages from people of how they've connected with the book, which is it like makes all of being a writer so beyond worth it hearing that.
Oh, that's good. That's good. What advice would you give neurodivergent middle schoolers or teens who are trying to learn more about themselves?
Ooh. Well, first off, I tell them they're not alone because I think I felt alone. So I want them to know they're not alone, that there's tools out there and that you can succeed and thrive and live an awesome life. Because I think a lot of the times what people tell neurodivergent kids is, you know, that you're lazy, you're a problem, a troublemaker. Like, we only hear, like, the bad stuff. So I want them to know that they can live, like, an awesome life and do awesome things.
Yeah, definitely. And you said that there are tools available. Can you talk a bit more about the resources that are there to help neurodivergent kids and adults, too?
Yeah, and there's a lot of really cool tools, and I feel like I'm only just beginning to unmine them. And so in the back of the book, there's a list of some resources that I've found particularly helpful, and as well on my website. And I try to update that one because, you know, I'm finding new things. But I think I mentioned a neuroclastic article on there of autism is a spectrum, doesn't mean what you think it means, which I love that article because I think it helps explain what this being autistic means, especially to folks that, you know, might not be autistic. And there's another site I really love, which is maybe more for adults, but it's Thinking Person's Guide to Autism. And that has really good articles and resources that, you know, a trusted adult could, you know, help an autistic kid with navigating that stuff.
You seem to be quite a prolific writer. Can you tell us a bit about your process?
Thanks. I feel like I'm so slow. I guess everyone is hard on themselves. I see writers that pump out books so fast and I'm like, oh, I'm so slow. My process, though, I don't quite know how to describe it. I'm always trying to take notes of what's interesting to me, what's exciting, what questions I have. What am I trying to learn? That's often a big thing because the writing process helps me learn and figure out things where I need to grow. And so I feel like it's kind of a growth process for me. But I think the most important thing is figuring out what is interesting because you're spending a long time writing this book and editing it. So I try to write out ideas of things that are interesting to me. And when I do that, often there's some common threads. So I may not stick with that specific sentence I wrote of what could maybe be a novel, but I wrote 10 or 15 sentences and they all had this kind of theme around them. And I go, oh, okay, I'm probably writing something about that. But then usually at some point, once that's been mulling for a few months, then suddenly words explode out of me. So I'm so not in control of this process. I think it's like very humbling being a writer because you realize I have no control. I just have to, you know, faithfully show up and see what happens.
Yeah. So then do you take a lot of your inspiration from just the world around you or?
Yeah. And I think I'm learning that what our lived experience is the most powerful thing. I used to think my life was so boring and there was nothing interesting for me to write about. And so I tried to write about things that weren't my life. And I found that those were less powerful of stories, less meaningful of ones. So I like to also think about, you know, what do I know? What things are part of my experience and using that as a launching point for my writing. And that's the stuff people go, this is your strongest stuff. So
that's good to hear you say. What about books? Do you take any inspiration from other books?
Absolutely. If you talk to most authors, they'll say, I don't like to read anything like my book while I'm writing. And I'm actually the opposite. I like to know what else are people in the world saying about this idea that I care about. Do I agree with what they're saying? Do I disagree? How can I add to this conversation? You know, there's certain topics I've been interested in, but then I've read books and said, oh, they kind of said what I already wanted to say. So what's the point of me writing a book? Books are a conversation. When I'm publishing something, I'm in conversation with the other books in the world. So I want to think about where would I be in this conversation that's happening.
Wow, that's so interesting. What are you reading right now?
I'm reading a lot of things. I tend to start like 10 different books. And so I'm trying to actually think of what I'm reading. I just finished yesterday 54 Things Wrong with Gwendolyn Rogers, which is a lovely middle grade novel about an ADHD girl. Or I guess she's not technically diagnosed ADHD, but she's clearly neurodivergent. And so that's a really fun, interesting one. But otherwise, I've got like 10 or 20 different middle grade and adult books. Oh, that's the one I was reading. Your Plantation Prom is Not Okay, which is a YA that I have just started, but I'm hooked on it. It is really, really good, really like a thoughtful, complex view of thinking about all the messiness in our world when it comes to race, especially about things like plantations. So I'd highly, highly recommend that one.
Okay, definitely. I'll have to check that out then. And finally, what do you think the most important message is for people to get from reading your book?
Oh, that's a great question. I think for neurodivergent kids, I really want them to know they're not alone and they can fly. We have so many tools for flying. And I want neurotypical readers to have empathy for a perspective that's different than their own. So if somebody does something that's surprising or strange, instead of assuming the worst in a person, trying to think, well, why is this person doing it? And actually, that's probably the message for everybody. I think in a lot of the stuff I write, I am somebody that's very judgmental. I'm quick to conclusions. And I'm really like examining that about myself, that I often make really ugly judgments about people. And then I learn more and I go, oh, wow, if I was in their shoes, I would do that thing. So when I'm writing, I feel like if there's a common thread in my stories, it's taking a character that you'd make assumptions about and then unpacking that and realizing like, oh, they're way more complicated, and just trying to encourage us as readers to not be so quick to judge and maybe ask questions before you make judgments.
I did get that from reading your book, so.
Oh, yay, good.
Yeah, I just want to say that I really loved your book. It was really, really good.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. Thank you so much for joining me today. It was great getting to speak with you.
Yes, thank you so much for having me, and such awesome questions. Like, I'm going to still mull over those questions, I think.
My guest today has been Meg Eden Kuyat, author of Good Different. My name is Phoebe Donovan, and you're listening to KGNU, Boulder, Denver, and Fort Collins.
That's it for today's Morning Magazine. I've been your host, Shannon Young. Thanks to Gavin McGough, Maeve Conran, and Phoebe Donovan for their contributions to this July 4th special program. Coming up is How on Earth, the KGNU Science Show, and then an archival lecture from Alan Watts. That's going to be on the other side of the BBC News headlines.